This is a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat with guest Eric Taylor. I'm your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond. For the best in Americana, alt country, indie rock, and more, point your browser to nosurfmusic.com.
You told GS how to write songs. Or to not to write songs.
Okay, let's all put our sunglasses on.
How to better his songwriting skills. To go back to Billy Joe Shaver, simplicity is the answer.
Oh, I
what can we take out of it?
I'll tell you the best Billy Joe Shaver story you'll ever hear.
I'm listening.
Billy and I, and the guy that owned JMI Records at the time, or was working for JMI, they had a house right next door. Where JMI Records used to be was Pat Boone's parsonage. Pat Boone's father's parsonage. That's where they had the JMI Records. That's Cowboy Clinton. That was where the office was. Hmm. Well, Billy was right next door with us. And we stayed up all night long. And sun's coming up. So Ray said, boy, it's nice and cool out here. I think I'm going to cut the grass. It's Sunday morning. And Billy was sitting out on the porch, screening the porch. We'd been drinking all night. Sun coming up. And Ray says, I think I'm going to cut the grass. So he gets out and cuts the grass and just pisses Billy off, no end. And he goes next door, where he lives next door, and he gets in his truck and he just throws gravel on, throws gravel all the way down the road. So we stopped him. Well, Ray stopped him. He said, what's wrong, Billy? Where you going? And Billy said, because it was Sunday morning, Billy said, I'm going to church to pray for your sinning ass. And just took off, man. Just took off. I'm going to church to pray for your sin and that. Cutting grass on a Sunday morning, you don't do it. You just don't do it.
My Panama told me, he goes, Billy always has had a bit of Elmer Gantry, you know.
Well, you know, we did a show together in Italy, and I think I told you this story before. But we did a show together in Italy, and it was a big festival. And so these women, these Italian women, got up with no shirts. And they were dancing. They were dancing with Billy, with Billy's songs. This is when his son was playing with him.
That was a great band.
And, they were all dancing with no shirts on and stuff like that. So, of course, security came, tried to get them off. Billy stopped the song and said, don't you touch those girls. God loves you when you dance.
I love me a Billy.
True story, man. I mean, I was just kind of sitting there going, thinking, I'm a part of this. I really am a part of this. No, don't you touch them. God loves you when you dance.
So you're
I'm going to
that
church to play for your sin and ass. Is the
But they weren't dancing on a Sunday, right?
No,
so that's the key.
It wasn't Sunday. It was a Friday.
Well, there you go. If they'd been dancing on a Sunday, he probably could have complained.
Well, if they were working.
Yeah.
Billy's life.
Billy ain't complaining.
It but it's Italy.
Billy
you never know when anybody's working in Italy because most everybody doesn't work, really.
Well, if you can get a job unless like that, that's the best job to have.
Unless you're in the fashion business and live in Milan, then you work. But everybody else in Italy just sort of takes naps, like Jay.
Jay works.
I know he does.
Hard.
But he doesn't write about working. He writes about
Right. He does write about naps a lot.
He does write about
I think I'm not satisfying him.
I thank him for that.
I want to
hear
naps,
about the
man.
You know the balance of the
well, doesn't write about his work. He never write. You never sent messages about work, really. Yeah. Well, yeah, you did. You did. You sent me a message said, I've got to give some kind of speech or some kind of talk or something. Anyway, but most of your shit is
funny.
is very funny shit. Like the dogs are barking at squirrels.
So here's what Jay's got.
That's my favorite. That will go in the top 10 of all the Jays. The dogs are barking at squirrels, but they're doing it from the comfort of the inside of the air conditioned house.
It's true.
I just thought, God damn it.
Hard to pick a favorite.
I dig it.
Yeah, there's so many. Even myself, who lives with him, and I can verify most. Sometimes he...
Oh, mostly you're the one that gives me the...
I do. I'm the inspiration to a lot of these stories. Like, you think it's fucking egg day? What'd you do for me? You want fucking
egg
eggs?
Day. Egg day.
Egg day is important. So my kids will call me.
Egg day.
And they'll be like, maybe lay some eggs.
Egg once a week?
Egg day is in the top 10 of my
days.
Yeah, Tammy's worried about my cholesterol, so she says I can have eggs once a week.
Well, you know, but really,
I actually think you can have them more, but I don't want to cook them more.
If you read about cholesterol, eggs do not...
Well, you can't go there.
Well, and another thing is, he can make fucking eggs every day of the week. He's got two orders.
I ain't going there. Can't go there. I ain't going there.
You go anywhere you want.
It doesn't matter. Here's the thing.
I just thought it was a great line.
He's a great writer.
If Tammy makes the eggs for you.
And they are made with love when I do.
So you can only have Tammy-made eggs once a week. For your cholesterol issues.
I just thought it was a great line. It's just not an egg day.
Nope. Well, that's after my daughters have called and said, will you make Jay some damn eggs? He's online because I'm not online. We're tired of him whining and eating
the eggs.
I just thought it was a great line.
Well, you're missing half. Yeah. But no,
egg day
and taco.
Today is not an egg day.
Egg day and taco night came together.
I need to learn to simplify.
Holy shit.
Well, we're...
you could always.
Yeah, here we are.
Do what you want to do, man.
Yeah, interview us.
I'm rolling with it. We're recording right now, but if you...
He's a ventriloquist. I'm on his lap.
Well, whatever works. Dummy. Well, all right, so... For anybody out there on the internet who is wondering what the holy hell is going on right now...
Here in Straysboro, in a suburb, in a garage...
That is our host, Tammy, who just filled you in on exactly where we are. We are in Streetsboro. We are.
Yeah, we are.
We are in Streetsboro, Ohio, at the Honky Tonk House Concert Series. Yeah, something like that. We are here with a gentleman who just played. This is a rare after-show interview, and has a brand new album out, which we'll talk about, and that is Mr. Eric Taylor. So, let's say hi, Eric.
It's good to see you.
Absolutely. And for those of you who also have no idea who I am, I'm Jason D. Diesel Hammond, your host, and this is another edition of Burning River Fireside Chats. So in addition to Eric, we have, like I said, our hosts, Tammy and Jay, and some of the... What's the terminology you use for people who hang out here? Your band of misfits or something, Jay?
Denizens or misfits or...
My best friends.
Something like that. All of Jay's best friends are misfits, is what we're saying.
Present.
Exactly. There we go. So I guess, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about Eric's music and what he does and his new album.
Okay.
But there's also a ton of great stories, as you may guess, and I want to hear them all.
Okay.
So we were just talking a little bit about Billy Joe Shaver.
Uh-huh.
And he's a favorite of ours, of course. And,
yeah, well, why wouldn't he be?
Absolutely. I mean, he is amazing, right?
Yeah, sure.
And
he's got a very good shot, though. he's a hell of a friend, but he's not a very good shot.
You know, he told me that was the luckiest thing that ever happened to him, because he'd never shot that gun before, and he just nicked the guy.
He nicked him.
Yeah, he just hit him in the only place you can hit a guy in the face without hurting him, really. So maybe he is a good shot. There you go.
Maybe he is. Well, you know, that's a different take on it, really. But in Texas, what we were calling him is a bad shot. Yeah.
Anyway, one of the other great stories that I had to ask him about when I talked with him was how he was in Texas, obviously, and decided to hitchhike out to L.A. and ended up in Nashville. My geography is not very good, but that doesn't seem to make much sense. You actually have a somewhat similar story, but your geography actually does make sense.
Yeah, it does.
Because you were out in, were you in D.C. or were you down in Atlanta at the time?
Well, I left D.C. I was born in Atlanta originally, but I was living in D.C. when I ended up in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd been there before because I had relatives there when I was a kid. So I had different people trying to raise me, you know. So, I mean, my parents just didn't seem to have the will or interest in it at all. But I was raised by a couple of sets of grandparents and ended up in Texas. Came back to Texas later on when I was on my way to California. That's
what I was getting towards, yes.
That's where you're going.
So you were sort of headed to the same place. Neither one of you made it there, but at least you're still going the right direction, right?
Right, yeah. I left D.C. I went to Georgetown briefly and realized that I wasn't a Catholic. It didn't work out, really. So I left, and there was somebody that was going to Houston, and then on to California. My original purpose of the travels was to go to California, like everybody else wanted to go at that time, I suppose, although it was all over there.
And what year was this, just so people know?
This was in 1969, I think.
Okay.
So it was all over California by that time.
But people still were going. It's like the gold rush, right?
Yeah, so good. Yeah. I got to Houston, and it was a very fertile town for writers and players. Towns Van Zandt lived there at that time. Guy Charles Clark lived there at that time. Lightning Hopkins, Big Mama Thornton. So, I mean, I could hear almost anybody on any night that I wanted to, and I saw Lightning Hopkins on a Friday night in a place called the Family Hand, and then on Saturday I saw a Towns Van Zandt, and that's when I said, I'm staying here.
This might be a good place to stick around if you like music.
Well, I got
right?
a job washing dishes in the joint, you know, and I play guitar.
That was when you decided you wanted to actually get into the music business and you wanted to get an education, and you decided to stay in Houston.
Sure.
And you mentioned a few of those guys, like Towns and like Guy Clark, who were there at the time. Can you just give us an idea of, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, what that scene was like with those folks out there?
It was just incredibly fertile from the standpoint of writers. I mean, if you look at what the Houston writing scene was, if you look at the writers that came out of Houston, really, I mean, Guy Charles Clark moved there from Rockport. He moved to Houston because Mickey Newberry lived there.
Okay.
So that Mickey was sort of the star at the end of that. So there was Mickey Newberry, and there was a couple other writers. Who's the guy with the Kenny Rogers lived there as well, and played little clubs out on Piedmont in Montrose. But Guy Charles Clark moved there really because from Rockport down there, or from because Mickey lived there, and then Towns moved there because Guy Charles Clark lived there, and I moved there because they all lived there. I mean, I stayed there because I could see these guys any night I wanted to. So it was, I mean, from the standpoint of a writing place, really, it was, as a writer, and at that time I was sort of a young, arrogant little intellectual asshole, actually, if you want to put it that way. You know, I didn't think that performing was very... I thought that was almost beneath me. I thought being a writer was it. So over the years, I've learned to enjoy performing. But I didn't then. I didn't. I did it only because I needed to get my songs out. Continue to answer your question. I mean, the reason that I stayed there was because of the writers that were there. And so many writers came out of Houston. I mean, Nancy Griffith ended up moving to Houston from Austin. And we had a relationship, and then, you know, there was also people, a younger group of people that came up after we did, people like Lyle Levitt and Robert Keane and that kind of business. But I mean, I remember Shaver, Billy Joe Shaver, playing at the Elkhorn. You know, I mean, it's a place that only held maybe 40 people, maybe. You know. If you really packed them in.
Right, right. Well, kind of like Jay's place here.
Yeah, yeah.
Billy Joe's coming, we pack them in. But
yeah.
So, who would you say was most influential to you from that scene? Who taught you the most as a writer?
Oh, from the scene.
From the Houston scene.
From the Houston scene.
Yes.
Well, I was very lucky, I think, to be a kid my age, to be able to play bass with Lightnin' Hopkins.
Okay.
Lightnin' probably was the guy that taught me about how to never play a song the same way twice, which I don't, as everybody will tell you. I'd never play the song the same way twice. And also, I mean, he taught me about storytelling and how to make stories out of songs, you know.
Okay. Well, actually, that...
But then Towns, of course. I mean, you can't be around somebody like Towns Van Zandt. You just can't without being influenced by... I mean, you can't be around Lightnin' Hopkins without being it. You know, I mean, it would be like if you were a boxing fan, it'd be something like that. You couldn't be around somebody like Muhammad Ali without being
picking up some stuff.
Of course, it's quite similar in some ways, I think.
So you are listening to these guys. And they're imparting a little bit of wisdom bit by bit on you.
Yeah.
What was the best thing that you learned, for instance, from Towns? Like, can you even verbalize it, or is it just, you know, getting his style in your head and working it from there?
I can tell you what the best thing I learned from him was wear a corduroy jacket and a paisley tie.
Well, that is a good plan, I guess, right? Works for me.
It would be like not being influenced by Johnny Cash, or not being influenced by any of the greats, really. But Guy Charles Clark influenced me to a degree, because he kept everything very close to his vest, really. I mean, I thought when I first met Guy Charles, I thought he had written like 20 or 25 songs already, but he hadn't. You know, he'd written like two or three.
Okay.
You know, he was doing covers. And I thought, wow, man, he must be wealthy. He must be really rich, because like James Taylor's doing the Fire and Rain, you know, which I thought Guy wrote.
One of them's rich, right?
Yeah, right. Well, I didn't have enough money to have a car with a radio in it.
Okay.
So it was only through my girlfriends that I was able to discover other people.
Okay.
But he was just being around Guy Charles and his wife, Susanna, at the time was a very, that in itself was just an influential thing, because they were both, I mean, they were writers, they were painters. Both of them painted very well, wall paintings. And actually, when I first met Guy, Charles Clark, he was working as a graphic artist for a CBS, that television show in Houston.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And a fan of mine, a news guy, came down and introduced us. And then we ended up realizing that we lived on the same street. Mm. You
know? Very cool.
But I was a kid. I was just a kid then. You know?
Well, you were a kid, as you say, and you were just starting out at the time. But one of the people that you did discover, as you mentioned, and ended up being a collaborator with, was Nancy Griffith.
Yeah.
And
well, we were married.
So right, maybe. Right. Well,
I almost didn't have a choice.
Oh, really? You mean I guess, you know, if you don't sing on my album and I don't sing on yours, we're in trouble, right?
I suppose it means... I suppose it means how you would take the word collaboration.
Okay. Well, what was that like then? Tell us what...
We didn't write together. Okay. No, I mean, there's one song that I co-wrote with Angie, which was pretty much of an accident. It was like, you know, we were living together, and she was working on a song, and I was walking through to go to a gig, actually, and she says, "Hey, hold it before you go. What do you think of this?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean, you know?" And she says, "Where do you think I should go with this?" And it was a song that we ended up writing together called Ghosts in the Music. And then the other collaboration that I've ever done is also was an accident. Was with Lyle. We wrote Fat Babies together. So, I mean, that, you know, I've never been much of a co-writer with anybody. Those are the only two people I've ever co-written with.
Okay. Well, you did both sing back and forth on each other's albums and stuff like that, though. Especially early on in both of your careers, right?
Sure. And even recently.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I've seen when you did your live album a few years ago. She was one of the folks that joined you. Yes. Sorry. What was the title of that again?
Live at the Red Shack.
Okay. I didn't want to step on that. I think I did.
Don't step on it.
Yes. Well, it's a good one to check out for people who want to see what you're really like. But in 1981, you came out with your first album, right? Which was
Shameless Love.
Shameless Love. Yes. I'm so bad with titles. I have to look at them. But then it was a long time before you came out with another one, right?
Yeah, which I didn't come out with another one until 1995.
Right, that was your Eric Taylor self-title. Yeah. So what was the reason for the delay there?
Well, I suppose everybody pretty much knows it, and I don't have any problem talking about it. I was strung out.
Mm-hmm.
I was a junkie. And I was successful at music business, even at being a junkie. But I knew that I had become so successful at that time that I had a European tour where I had a number two record there. And I knew that if I went, I wouldn't make it back. So I stopped shooting up in 83.
Okay.
So I ended up being kind of pulled back into the music business by Lyle and some other people in 95, actually. I went out, me, Ricky Lee Jones, and a bunch of other people went out to California and sang on Lyle's I Love Everybody record. Mm-hmm. And it allowed me to meet some people, other people in the publishing business that wanted to hire me. So okay. I got signed by PolyGram from that, with Lyle's help, I must say. And it allowed me to kind of come back into the business, getting paid to write songs. Allowed me to go out and lose money at gigs. So. Yeah, that was a very, very kind and helpful thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And a very enigmatic, actually, thing. Because, I went out there to sing on a few songs, And Lyle, out of his graciousness, said, hey, why don't we just set up a couple of mics and why don't you just shoot some songs, you know? I mean, and I think we shot like 18 songs that night. Julie Roberts was there. It was pretty cool.
Okay.
You know, it's when he and Julie were together.
Right.
But... And we
would have been quite as convenient if they'd been broken up and she was still hanging out in the studio,
it
right?
It wouldn't have mattered, really.
Okay.
I found her to be a very, very nice woman, and she was very kind to me. So I'm, and she always has been, and still is.
Cool.
So, but it was one of those things where I was ready to come back into the business, but Lyle... Lyle was instrumental in getting me back into the business, really.
When you were working on getting cleaned up then, through that whole time period, was it something that you missed? Was it something that you were thinking about doing? Or was
I still wrote songs.
Okay.
No, I went back to school, became an LPC, became a licensed professional counselor, and worked with the junkies coming out of Texas prison. So, I also taught ethics at the University of Houston to psychologists and counselors.
Interesting. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was 13 years of well-spent time, I think.
But right. But in many ways, completely the opposite direction of where you'd been going.
I think I was ready to come back into the business. And when Lyle allowed that... to happen, I thought it was really cool.
Cool.
I
mean, so
without him, I don't think I would have gotten the Polygram deal.
Okay.
I mean, he's the one that said, you need to really listen to this guy. This is a guy that was a really great influence on me and so forth. And by his graciousness and his kind will, I got signed with Polygram. Publishing, so it allowed me to come back in the business. Like I said, I mean, otherwise I would have been, you know, doing nothing.
Right. Well, doing nothing artistically, but like you said, you had a lot of other stuff going on.
Yeah, but so. I had done that. I had when I finished that, I had finished it.
Okay.
When the insurance industry fell out of the bottom of the of recovery, then I found myself in working in places that weren't ethical at all, and were doing some really nasty shit. So I said no way.
So it was a good time for you to get back into music then. Okay. So what I was saying. Before we came inside to stop getting eaten for those mosquitoes. For those of you who may have heard a strain in my voice, that's what it was. I was getting bit about a billion times sitting outside talking. But I was just saying, one of, I think, the most interesting descriptions I've ever heard of a musician was about you and came from Nancy Griffith.
Uh-huh.
And she said that you were the William Faulkner of songwriting.
Uh-huh.
And in some ways that is so appropriate because, you know, what you do, especially since I've just seen your live act, it really is a storytelling more than it is music in some ways. Well, it's all about...
Yeah, it's not some guy... standing up there playing in A minor and love songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's stories about people and characters. That's my only interest in this business, really, is being able to write about the characters that I have been fortunate enough to meet. You know, I do read a lot. I have a huge library at my house, and I'm an avid reader. As are my friends.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I got, for instance, I just got turned on to last year a friend of this place here who lives close around named Paul Bear, who
mm-hmm.
wrote a book called Jim Tully, where tomorrow, actually, I'm going to do the
I'm going to play the opening of the film for the first time, and they're going to show the film, and then I'm going to do a set of my own. I mean, so it's by this kind of thing that I get to meet those kind of people. Is what I'm trying to say.
I got you.
I mean, if it weren't for Jay and Tammy, I would have never met Paul Bearer. Mm-hmm. Nor would I have been given a book, because he said, "How much are your records?" And I said, "Well, how much is your book?" He said, "Well, my book is $35. And I said, "Well, that'll be two records on your part, and I've given you a deal." So, because I sell my records for $15 apiece. Anyway, I gave him the two records, and he sent me the book. But without being here, without being at this place, for instance, Scottsboro? What's the name of the town?
St. Mary's, where we're
going. No,
here, Streetsboro.
Streetsboro. Oh.
Yeah, Statesboro.
Yes.
I mean, if I hadn't been Statesboro High, for instance,
I love that.
I would have never been able to meet Paul Bearer and have him say, "Hey, how much your records?" I said, and Jay told me about the book. I said, "How much is your book, man?" And tell me. I said, "Well, it'd be two records. I'm giving you a deal." So, with
I met you on the same line.
Pretty much true.
Yeah. Pretty much.
This is Tammy. This is Tammy talking.
We've met before, I think, right?
Yeah. I believe so.
I think so.
Well, I'm just telling the audience.
Yes. No. Well, she's the only female here. So if you can't tell her, something's really wrong.
She's Tamsterina.
There you go. Oh,
by God.
So, you mentioned the Tully book.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that ended up coming in on Studio 10,
yeah.
Your new album, right?
I wrote two songs on Studio 10 about Tully.
So, tell us a little bit about what that story is.
About Tully.
Oh, yeah.
And
your songs as well, you know.
Well, he was a guy from St. Mary's, Ohio. Parents were Irish immigrants, very influenced by his grandfather, Huey.
Mm-hmm.
He was a rogue kid, and back in those days, you're talking about back in the Depression era, in the 20s, he was a rogue kid who rode the rails, and he was given up by his family because he had six or seven other siblings, and they couldn't take care of him. So he was given up to an orphanage in St. Mary's.
Mm-hmm.
So he grew up in St. Mary's, Ohio, there. And he took off. He sort of escaped from the orphanage, I would say. And he rode the rails for a while, being a road kid. He came back to St. Mary's and then worked in the chain factory there.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was incredibly interesting that he would come back, and he was a short, stout fella who'd sort of grown up on the rails, but came back and got a job in St. Mary's, the place that he'd skate.
Mm-hmm.
You
see the world, but you come back home, right?
Right. Well.
Even if you don't like home necessarily.
Right. Well, I think you go back to where. You may go back where some of your blood is, whether it's a good idea or not,
mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But whether it's a good idea or not, you may go back to where your blood is. And so he went back, and the only job that was around at the time for somebody like him, uneducated kid that had grown up on the rails, was working in a chain factory in St. Mary's. So, I found that part of it very fascinating, that he came back to the thing that had chased him away.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I mean?
Absolutely.
I found that first part of it, and the way Paul and David had written this book, they've done so much
research. I think we spent like 12 years researching this.
20 years.
20 something years. 20 something years.
It's the internet. Swear as much as you want.
Swear as much as you want.
You've never even read one of my articles. You don't know how much I swear. Jay's the one who knows how to use a computer, you know?
I'm used to Tom.
But anyway, Jay told me, because of just me playing here, Jay's at the honky-tonk, which is now becoming famous all over the world. I mean, there have been people from Europe that want to come over and play the honky-tonk, you know?
As they should.
Yeah.
It's a great
well,
venue.
And by God, they will. Unless I say no.
Ah, there you go. Yeah. Well, you got to have a good programming director. No. Sometimes Jay slacks. Come on, let's all face it, you know?
Well, he...
Mostly he doesn't. I'm his wife, and I will attest to that.
Well, that's how the hell I got here.
No, Jay has some of the best musical taste of anybody, and he just left the room.
So does she.
That's true. Tammy is great, too.
Mostly Jay's passionate, and I'm just a student in his work.
But, I mean, it's how it happened. I mean, it's
a cool part, isn't it?
Sure. It's a real part of being a carny, you know, like we all are. I mean, we all start out thinking that we want to be artists, and we end up realizing that really what we are is just a bunch of fucking carnies, aren't we? So it all becomes sort of like one thing meets another, you know, and it's one interest becomes another interest, and there is an evolution to it. So I mean, my being able to play here, Jay and Tammy's place, was my introduction to Paul Bear and to Jim Tully. So when I read the book, I was absolutely fascinated in it.
Okay.
So I read it the first time, then read it again, then read it again. And then I started writing about it. And then from that, through Jay and Paul, I got in touch with the filmmaker that was doing a documentary about Tully, and he said, I really love these songs that you've written about Tully. Would you mind writing the music for the film? And I said, of course. Wade Stone is the guy.
Okay.
And so tomorrow, we'll be doing the I'm going to do a show
release
after.
I'm
going to do a show after the release of the film. So I mean, and we're doing it in St. Mary's, Ohio, which is
also,
you know, I mean, it's where it should be done, really.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and I'm going to get to meet Emmett Lawler's grandnephew, I suppose. You know, Tully wrote a book called Emmett Lawler, and so I'm going to get to meet Death Lawler tomorrow.
Okay.
So
it's a whole big bunch of connections that all started here.
Well, because of that, I've read most of Tully's books, the ones that I can find. I've read them. I guess I've read 6 or 7 of them. I don't know, 12 or 13 heroes. You can't find them all. But I think through Kent State University, I think now there will be a printing of all of his books because of Paul and David.
Well, that's cool.
Isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. I mean it's so tough for the way the publishing industry is right now for, you know, anybody to sort of stick around in that world unless you're a bestseller, you know? And so a lot of people are like that, you know?
Well,
they do great stuff.
One time he was a bestseller.
Right.
You know, at one time, Tully.
But that was yesterday. Nobody cares about yesterday in business.
Ago.
No, that's what I mean. But
he
like,
fell
you know,
off the end of the fucking world, didn't he? I mean, he did. But at one time, he was selling more books than Hemingway and Fitzgerald put together.
Mm.
I mean, he was that popular writer for people because he was so there for them. And, of course, Fitzgerald, being an Irishman, of course, wrote about a different area of being an Irishman in America. Tully wrote about being an Irishman in America and from a different, a completely different standpoint from being, you know, a road kid or a worker or steel worker or whatever, you know, or a whore. He wrote a great book about whores. I have no idea how he might have done that.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of those things where you just gotta do research, I suppose, you know?
Well, I think you probably researched.
Probably a little bit. A little bit. Yes.
Tammy should go to bed now.
I think the old Tully Chaplin, yes. Charlie Chaplin.
No.
I like the whole Tully Charlie Chaplin connection, too.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah. That whole. You know, he worked for Chaplin, too, Tully.
I did not, actually.
It is a very cool.
He wrote for him.
Oh, yeah?
He wrote for him. And also, he wrote for W.C. Fields.
Okay.
So, I mean,
even more so.
But when he's his falling out with Chaplin, I think he worked with Chaplin for 8 or 9 years, I think, if I remember correctly, and I'm sure I do. he had a falling out with Chaplin shortly after the Hearst murder on the ship on the boat, and he had a falling out with him. And when you have a falling out with somebody like Charlie Chaplin in Hollywood, I mean, like I say in the song, you know.
It's a big fucking deal.
Yeah. Hollywood's just a place to hang your soul, man.
Right.
You know? But anyway.
Kind of like Nashville, but we'll not get into
that. Yeah, well, that's a hard run. But what happened to Tully was that when he sort of fell off the end of the world as a novelist, then he started becoming a critic in Hollywood and was the first man, first person, besides, then later came Dorothy Parker, to be called the most dangerous person in Hollywood because he became a critic.
Mm-hmm.
And he had written for some of the best. I mean, he'd written for Chaplin, he'd written for Fields, he'd written for so many different people. I mean, going all the way back to silent movies he had written. So then he became, I mean, when he got fired by Chaplin, then he became a critic.
Right. So it's interesting, he kind of got nailed by the establishment and then became the guy you don't want to tick off. So.
He got absolutely nailed by the establishment.
I'm learning just sitting here talking.
Well, all of you musicians out there who may be listening to that, that's why you should treat me nice. Because, you know, if you don't, I will write a bad review. And everybody knows you can't sell a record in this country if Diesel gives you a bad review. But I guess sort of an offshoot of that whole story is because we were talking about Jay and Tammy introducing you to all of them. Sort of on the reverse side of that, Jay and Tammy introduced me to you.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't have heard about you had they not done that.
Well, bless
and,
their hearts. Yeah. I mean, that's a good deal.
Well, see, that's one of the great things about what they do. And I mean, I tend to think I'm pretty knowledgeable about music compared to most people, at least I try to be.
Yeah.
But the people that these guys know, you know, are people who, unless you have a connection, you probably are never going to find out about them.
No, well, I don't know that that's completely true. Mm-hmm. I know it's true in many ways. I know that Jay and Tammy have introduced me to a lot of people that have helped me, but it was just another place to play for me when I first came here.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got here, what I did was I found people who loved me and appreciated me and who knew probably more about my music than I did, really. Mm-hmm. Almost like Europeans, Jay and Tammy. They'll say, oh, no, I think you did that in 1987 or whatever. But you see what I mean? I mean, you've got people who In my opinion, it's the thing that keeps the industry going, really. I mean, otherwise you're going to end up with people like, you know, Bieber and what's his name? Is it Bieber?
Justin Bieber, the bane of all musical existence.
Well,
yes.
I don't think you. You know, I mean, you know, fucking hell. There's been people who's probably been worse.
This is true. But he's just sort of on top of the band now.
He's
yeah.
the name now that yeah. everybody wants to call.
Well, I mean, it's
know,
the
Swift,
big music.
Swift
right.
and that kind of deal.
I mean, you big know, music has become lowest common
I'm
denominator.
I'm an older guy. I mean, mm-hmm. people like me and Shaver are all, we're old fuckers, really. I mean, and we've been doing this quite a long time, you know. I mean, Guy Charles Clark is 71 years old now. And I'm 60, I'll be 64 my next birthday. And for me to be able to play as many shows a year as I'm playing is
commendable.
Well, yeah, and it makes me a lucky boy actually, really, because I mean, I continue to. I mean, I meet friends through Jay and Tammy that have other shows.
Well, I was thinking.
Love me and you know, standing ovations and all that kind of, or ovulations actually.
One of the two.
One of the two.
But I was just gonna say, I think it's really interesting to me because a lot of the folks that I talk to in the music industry are either just starting out, or they're people like you who've been around for a long time, and it amazes me that. No musician who is in your position ever wants to quit. You know, no musician wants to stop making music. And any other job in the world, you know, you want to be retired from it. I know Jay, who is an accountant, is looking forward to the day when he doesn't have to be an accountant anymore.
Well, he'll do this.
Well, exactly. But you get to do it all on your own. So, you know, you can keep playing as a musician and you never want to quit,
well,
right?
You know, I think... It's a very interesting thing about how it's looked at these days, isn't it? I mean, B.B. King is still playing, and everybody's still going to see him, and nobody is asking him to retire. Nobody's asking he's going to retire. You know, I played with Lightnin' Hopkins right up until the very end, and I don't think Lightnin' would have ever thought of retiring, nor Manslipska, nor Fred McDowell, who I also played with. So... For what I do, no, I don't look at retirement. I'll probably die doing what I do, you know. I mean, it's just one of those things. What else am I going to do, really? I mean...
Well, you could go fishing a lot. I mean,
well,
it's true.
I could go fishing a lot. And when I can fish, I do fish.
Yeah. You just don't want to do that 200 days a year. You'd rather be playing, huh?
I'd much rather be writing than playing. I mean, I'm glad that I'm still writing at my age. Because there's a lot of people who don't write singular songs at their age. I mean, there's a lot of people at my age that are writing... For instance, like Guy Charles Clark, for instance, who I have an enormous love for, and no distance between us at all. But I mean, Guy's doing a lot of co-writing now with two, three, or four other people at a time. I couldn't do that. I just couldn't. I think for me to be my age and writing singular songs as I'm doing, I think that's important to me.
Okay.
And I think when I can't do that, I think then maybe I'd start robbing banks or gas stations or something like that. Oh, come on, Tim, you know.
Well, you don't have to co-write, but
well,
you don't got to rob banks.
But it might be fun. Come on, let's face it.
Robbing gas stations could be fun.
They're easy. Come on.
We're getting off track.
Yeah. It's all good.
It's kind of a bonding plot thing, dude.
Speaking of co-writing, Phil Lee made one of the best comments I ever heard when somebody asked him about living in Nashville and having friends like Peter Cooper and Eric Brace and Tommy Womack and all these other great songwriters, and if you ever get into co-writing, and Phil said, I don't need any help.
I don't either.
Simplicity don't need grease. I think that's a Billy DeShaver term, is it?
Yeah.
It is now, that's for sure.
No, I don't think I need any grease. The two songwriters, the two co-writes I've written have been completely accidental.
Mm-hmm.
And,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on you there, but in that case, let's talk about a couple of the things that you've been writing lately. We talked a little bit about the two Tully songs on Studio 10.
Yeah.
We started out about talking about how Jay and Tammy introduced me to you, and I actually first got to listen to Studio 10 yesterday because I tramped over here and borrowed Jay's copy, so I'm not the biggest expert on it yet. But I'm sure Jay has gone through it. So could you suggest a song that you particularly found interesting? And maybe we can have you talk about that, Eric.
No, I guess, you know, without a doubt, the song Bill, because of the, I'm big on the emotional connection. And I kind of know some of the backstory. I know I didn't know Bill, but I know the people where he played his last show. And I know Bill from his music, and then to hear what Eric's done in terms of writing a song, it's a pretty amazing piece of work to me.
And for people who don't know, because they haven't heard the record yet, which Bill are we talking about?
Bill Morrissey.
Okay. And so what was the reason you chose to write that song about him?
Because he was a friend, a very close friend of mine, and... I've never written things from a cathartic, any cathartic reasons, mm-hmm. but I mean, the song about Bill, shortly after Bill died, and him being my friend and quite close, the song came. And it was written. Very rarely would I ever do something like that, really. I mean, I don't write catharsis-type tunes. Mm-hmm. Mostly I write character songs, you know. I mean, like I said, I'm a guy that writes about characters. I don't write a lot of songs about me. I write songs about other people.
Mm-hmm.
I know who I am. I don't find myself that interesting, really. But I find other people very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for instance, if we were talking about the Tully thing.
Mm-hmm.
When given something of that nature, I'll take it and run with it, really.
Okay.
But Bill, from the standpoint of what Jay is saying, it was a song that, one of the very few songs that I've ever written that I thought had to be written the way it was written. It's very simple, and it's very about Bill. So, I mean, I was able to write a song about a man that I love very much and a friend that I loved very much. That I was able to leave myself out of most of it. But I put enough of myself in it to have it be a song.
Okay. Well, I mean, that everything comes from your own perspective. And, you know, there's the idea, I guess, sometimes, you know, when you're looking at something, that inherently changes it.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you're going to then take that and translate it into a song, it's all got to be from what you know and your perspective.
Well,
so there's no real way.
There's also a song in here called Francistown, which I wrote in a barrel house kind of sound as a tribute to my old friend Dave Van Ronk.
Oh, okay.
Out of New York. But, I mean, Dave's been dead now 10 or 12 years, I suppose. But I'd never been able to write a song about him. that I wanted, that or that I ended up liking. So what I did was write a song like he would write.
Oh, okay.
So Francistown is basically a tribute to Ben Rock. String of Pearls at the end of the record is a tribute to one of my close friends at home. So he died. Got to go see before he died.
So I guess it seems like a lot of the people who made it onto this album in one way or another directly influenced you or who were people that you knew. I mean, obviously the Tully story is something that was historical and all that. And obviously, like you said, you know, one of the things that you do as a musician is go around the country and meet people and then, you know, sort of adapt their stories sometimes.
To write on this record. If you listen to the record all the way through, there's three or four songs on there about strong women.
Mm-hmm.
And it started out with a conversation I had with a woman, a writer, a friend of mine from Seattle, Washington. And I said, you know, I wonder what it'd be like for me to write a record, write a whole record from the perspective of women. And she says, well, I think it would be difficult. And she was right. But I was able to get three or four songs out of it. Like Molly's Painted Pony is about a woman who took no shit in large numbers from anyone. She took care of it. There's also a song in there about a woman that's called Adios. It's about a woman who's saying, you know, she's had enough.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's taking her shit and she's leaving. And she's saying adios. And there's another song on there that goes the same direction. So, I mean, when I put it together, I mean, I really was. I mean, I had written these songs about, I was starting to write this little dialogue actually about the strength of women and how important it is. And I don't know very many men who write about it from that perspective. I don't know very many men who write from a female perspective. And to me, as a writer, I saw that as a challenge that I wanted to meet, you know.
But I totally understand, because actually, I mean, a lot of times when I'm writing, you know, I like to have a female main character. In some ways, just to make it farther away from me, so I can think about, you know, what it would be like to be in that situation versus, you know, writing about something that I necessarily know about. I kind of like taking those challenges on, too, so I can totally see that.
Well, you know, I think a lot of it came from my conversations with my friend in Seattle, which I'll have remain nameless.
Okay.
But
there aren't that many people in Seattle. I'm sure we can guess who it is.
Well, it's also because I've been married 4 times.
Yeah, okay.
Damn.
You know, I mean, I haven't been very successful at being able to understand the challenges that women have had with me.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very truthful with you. I mean, there's so many things that I think I probably did. Not physically abusive necessarily, but maybe physically abusive from the standpoint of being emotionally abusive. So I think there's an interest that I have in that, and the strength that I've seen in women, and I wish that there were more men who wrote about the strength that they see in women, especially based on their falls, you know, with the men's falls.
Right.
I could hang out here all day.
Well, it's your place.
Get
so
in
you can
here,
if you
girl.
Want.
Get in.
I going to hug my man because he treats me right.
That sounds like a plan.
You see what I mean?
So, so a song that you you mentioned in there was the lead-off track, which is Molly's Painted Pony.
Yeah.
And I want to just sort of give people an idea of some of the interesting points on that song, because I think in a lot of ways it's a kind of a good encapsulation of what you do, because it's a song that goes through a number of different stylistic elements, and it seems to be a lot of your songs... What you're doing musically reflects the picture of the mood that you're trying to set, like,
or it's a piece of it's a piece of writing when I put the music out.
Right.
So I mean, with Molly, for instance, you know, I mean, it's one of America's life stories, really. I mean, you know, she finds her sister with her husband, and she goes down the street, and she gets a gun from the gunsmith, and she shoots them both, and then she ends up dying. And so, it is a part of... primitive Americana, I think, that has not left itself to be primitive. I mean, you know what I mean?
Well, it depends on if you think we're still primitive or not.
Well, you know, I think it's a story that could still happen today.
Right.
It may not happen on a horse. It may happen in a, it may happen with a Honda. But, you know, I think... The way I wanted to write it was that she was taking care of business.
Okay, I got
you.
Know
what I mean?
Well, I like I said, I find it interesting because you know, in contrast to what some other people do, I think it goes back to that Faulkner thing in some ways that. We were talking about before, but you actually mentioned in one of your songs, you obliquely reference, well, maybe not that obliquely, but On the Road.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I feel like that's more about what you're doing than anything else. It's that sort of stream of consciousness.
I was very influenced by those guys.
Okay.
The early Kerouac stuff, I was very interested. You know, On the Road, of course, certainly played a great part in my life because... of how old I am and when I read it. You know, I first read it when I was 12 years old, and I've read it ever since, every 2 years, I suppose, since then.
It's a good one to reread, for sure.
Of course, you know, and I have a copy of the scroll on the original version.
Okay.
But, you know, most people don't realize about that book was that it was not written about one trip. It was written about four different trips from New York to San Francisco with he and Neil Cassidy. It wasn't about one trip. It was written in 1949. It wasn't published until September of 1957.
Mm-hmm.
So... by that time, Jack had changed quite a bit, and I was never able to meet Jack. I've been able to meet Corso, and I've been able to meet Ginsberg, was a friend of mine.
Very cool.
But Jack had pretty much lost himself long before that.
Mm-hmm.
So. Jack wrote this piece about freedom following, in 1949, following the war, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody thinks it was written in 1957, but it wasn't written in 49. It wasn't published until 1957.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that to be, when I do the song about Dean Moriarty, Don't Live Here No More, it's... Mm-hmm. What I mean. I mean, that's where I got the line.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm sad about the way the way that Jack died and what people think of him and that kind of deal. And Neil as well, Neil Cassidy as well. I mean, I got to meet Cassidy's wife, Carolyn.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Got to meet her. I got to meet Jack's. I got to meet Jack's daughter, Jan, who's written who wrote a couple of novels before she drank herself to death as well. I mean, she did exactly the same thing that her father did. She. I mean, there were people like me and Ginsberg and others that did everything we could do to try to help her, but. She wouldn't accept it.
Right. Well, a lot of people are like that.
Well, of course.
A lot of artists especially, it seems to be, you know, some of what you were saying earlier, it's just part of the life, and, you know, you were lucky, I think, obviously.
Well, I became a carny.
Yeah, there you go.
Those were people who were very, I mean, Kerouac's On the Road was a very, I read it when I was 12 years old, like I said, and it was an incredible influence on me. But so many others were as well. Corso and Burroughs.
Right. You can really tell as a listener, at least I certainly could, when I was listening to you live tonight, more so than on the studio albums, but you can tell that you're steeped in that sort of world. Because, honestly, I think the closest description to what you do on stage is you're basically a beat poet, and you got the guitar, and you're doing your entire thing, and then you're playing some notes behind it to accentuate it. Would you say that's fair?
I would say that that's very fair.
Okay.
I would say that I thank you for it. I think I'm an actor as well. I write plays as well as songs. So I have an interest in acting, and I think a lot of what I do on stage is acting.
I would say absolutely.
A lot of people think that you know, this shit comes right off the top of my head. It's not. It's written. It's most of it's written. Jay's heard me enough to know that these are written pieces, and I think there is an important part of the song than the song itself.
Right. Well, you definitely do it in an extemporaneous manner, so I can understand why people would think that.
But. Sure. I think there's some people that can pull it off, and there's people that can't. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you can. I think most people, really, that come to listen to what I do, can tell the difference between a phony and somebody who's not.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's all I'm interested in. You know, is I don't want anybody to leave thinking I was a phony.
I think there's a small chance of that, probably, if they go to one of your shows, for sure.
Yeah. All right, friends, I'll tell you what, I am on fumes.
Okay. Well, Jay, before
this
you run...
I love you.
I'll be here in a moment.
I won't be, but it's all good. Before you run...
You may be, you have been.
That's true. You actually told me that I had to ask Mr. Taylor a specific question.
I did.
And since you're here and you're about to go to bed and we want to wrap this up, go ahead and ask him so that all of our listeners can hear the story.
Well, when we were over at Harmony in the house at the Bottle Brush Gallery, told a story about Sterling Hayden.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I had seen movies that Sterling was in, but I didn't know who he was. And he introduced me to a friend of yours. And I'm glad I met him, although he died in 1986.
Yeah.
And I just think that's worth retelling. Because
he was a very, very dear friend. And I met him when I was going up to meet this very suspicious record producer in Sausalito. And I was driving the 1963 Volkswagen, I think is the story that he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a pop, and go anymore. And then the next thing I know, I see the morning. Are you going to be around?
Yeah.
Thanks, Jay. Catch you later.
I met him. There was a guy pulled up behind me in a an old beat up Carmen Ghia car, and he got off the car. He got off the car with a glass of whiskey or a glass of rum, actually, in this hand, and two cigarettes in this hand. And he says, "What's wrong with your right, boy?" And I said, "I think it's the clutch." Anyway, he ended up fixing my clutch cable with some shark line that he had, because he was a sailor.
Okay.
Sterling Hayden was an actor, but he only acted because he wanted to sail.
Well, you need money to do that, right? So.
Well, there's a book that I would suggest that everybody read by Hayden, a book called Voyager. The name of his boat.
Okay.
And then there's another book that he wrote. It's a fictional piece it was supposed to be written in it was written during the period of the 1800s called Voyager. Or The Voyage. No, The Voyage. The Voyage. That was the name of it. Now, Voyager was the name of his boat.
Okay.
He never let anyone call it a yacht. But, he didn't like it, but he was a great actor. He was the actor that was the chief of police that broke Michael Corleone's nose,
mm-hmm.
Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
The first
and,
Godfather.
And also in one of my other favorite movies, which was the Stanley Kubrick classic,
yes.
Dr. Strangelove, and he was awesome in that.
He was the colonel.
Yep. Unforgettable role, too. I mean, and one of the only roles that wasn't played by... I can't remember his name. Who's the star of that film? One of the most famous actors in history. Peter Sellers, of course. It was one of the only roles in the entire movie that Peter Sellers didn't play, it seems. And he was just amazing in it.
Sterling was an incredible friend, and he was, I'm so lucky to have been able to meet someone like him because, I mean, he was a guy that had a set of balls that you could bounce against anything without bitting them, you know what I mean? He was one of those guys, and he was real. None of it was forsaken anyway. He was very real.
Well, you kind of have to be to meet a guy in the streets and jump under his car and put it together with some fishing line.
Shark line.
Yeah, exactly. You got to know what you're doing, right? It's not an affectation at that point.
Well, the great thing about it is the story. The great thing about the story was I realized who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, when he was crawling up underneath my carpet with my Volkswagen van with this... 250 pounds of shark line to repair my clutch cable. I said, "Mr. Hayden, is there any way I can help you?" And he says, "No, boy, you wouldn't know how to tie the knot." In other words, it was a fishing knot.
Right.
It was tied. And, he drove only Volkswagens. He drove old Volkswagens and old Carmen Ghia's, yeah. So, he had three or four or five of them, actually, in his place. But he also had, behind his house, he had, he had laid some rail line, and he put a caboose back there. And that's where he lived while he was building his house inside.
Okay.
So when I stayed with him, I stayed in the caboose. It was then the guest house.
Oh, that's cool.
Which had a little cook stove in it. It was just brilliant. I mean, you could spend days out there and not see him, really, you know. But he was quite the incredible character. I mean, you can look up Sterling Hayden and see interviews that he did with people like Dick Cavett or Tom Snyder. You're probably too young to know who Tom Snyder is.
I'm vaguely aware. I've never seen his show, obviously. But
I mean, all the you can look up Hayden, Sterling Hayden, and you can see all the different interviews, and you can see what a character he was. Just 3 days ago, I had a goatee that went down here, just like Hayden's did.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Then my goatee became more famous than me.
I hate when that happens.
So I cut it off. I'll grow back.
Yeah. Well, see, that's one of the nice things about beards. You know, I change them all the time, too. You can do whatever you want, right?
Yes.
So I guess just to close things off, I want to remind everybody that your new album is called Studio 10.
Oh, yeah.
And it came out in June, correct?
Yes.
And what would you like people to know about it? What's the driving thing behind it that you think music lovers need to know before they decide?
Well, it's the first real studio album I've done in 7 years. I mean, I've done Live at Red Shack in between that, which is really, I mean, it's a studio album, but it's live. Yeah. This is the first one that I've... After the heart surgery, I had a triple bypass, and although I've never suffered from writer's block, I think there was a time where I really slowed down. And this record was I wanted it to be quite immediate. So when I finished the song, I wrote and still cut it.
Okay.
As opposed to how I'd done before, where I would save up 15 songs and go in there and do 12 of them and see which ones were.
So how long, if it just wasn't one session, how long of a time period was it between?
A year and a half, probably.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of times going into the studio to finish things up. That's pretty cool. I've never really heard of anybody recording that way before in, you know, a serious...
I'd never recorded that way before. I'd always thought that I needed to have my shit together before I went in, you know? And I wanted these songs to be really on the bone, you know?
Well, okay. So can you just let everybody know then... where Studio 10 is available and what your website
is? It's on blueRubyMusic.com. We've decided not to have any downloads on it. You can hear pieces of it, but it's on blueRubyMusic.com. You can buy it there. But, you know, I've decided not to do any more of the
digital downloads.
I've decided not to do it. I've kind of figured out I'm an old school guy, and I've been, you know, they're really screwing me on the money. I'm really getting screwed on the money, so I'm just not doing that anymore. If you want the record, buy it. If you don't want it, then don't.
There you go. Well, like you said, it's available on your site, so everybody should get on over there.
BlueRubyMusic.com.
BlueRubyMusic.com. The album is Studio 10. The gentleman who wrote and sang and played on all of the songs is Eric Taylor. And I want to thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Great. Well, I definitely had a lot of fun, and those are some great stories, so hopefully everybody listening at home enjoyed it too. And once again, like you said, we should thank our hosts, Jay and Tammy, at the Honky Tonk House Concerts, not only for having Mr. Taylor here to play for us, but allowing us to stay in their home and do this interview. Yeah, so it's always great stuff.
Right.
And this has been, once again, another edition of No Surf Music's Burning River Fireside Chat. Eric, thanks again.
Thank you, man.
And everybody out there, we'll see you next time. This is Jason D. Diesel Hammond, your host, signing off.
This has been a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond, signing off. Remember, No Surf Music is your source for the best in Americana, alt country, indie rock, and more. For original reviews and interviews, visit nosurfmusic.com.